Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Try out the NPR One app for your phone for conversations you won't hear anywhere else. This week, find Guy Raz's exclusive interview with TED curator Chris Anderson, where they discuss the TED phenomenon and the secrets to giving a great TED Talk. Find their conversation by searching TED Radio on the NPR One app, where you can also find great stories from your local station and more great podcasts. NPR One is in your app store now.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
So Stephen and I are here to introduce this week's Pop Culture Happy Hour, which we taped live in New York at the Vulture Festival.
Yes, on Sunday, May 22nd. Marvelous crowd.
It was big fun, and you'll all be glad to know that our fourth chair on this show is Audie Cornish, who, you know, what's not to like about Audie Cornish?
Nothing, that's what.
As you may or may not know, Vulture is the entertainment section of New York Magazine. Because it was the Vulture Festival, we talked a little bit about the things that we pick over like vultures, and then we had a conversation about the intersection of politics and pop culture. We hope that you enjoy this show, and we'll be back next week with a show about, I'm just going to say, supervillains. So enjoy. We are so grateful to be here with Vulture, and in their honor, we decided we would go with a Vulture-themed segment. We struggled with how to describe it in a way that was more persistence-themed and less carcass-themed. And what we eventually came up with is we're going to talk about the things that we kind of keep picking over long after the world is done with them. Glenn is sort of the one who was putting this topic together and kind of came up with it. What's an example, Glenn, of the kind of thing that you find yourself picking over?
Well, I went very literal with this, actually more toward the carrion thing, because I wanted to make clear that vultures pick over things that are not simply dead but rotting. They eat putrescence. They can eat the anthrax bacteria, they can eat the botulism bacteria, and because... Fun science fact that you probably didn't expect to get
really
from our little
researched this.
Pop culture dog and pony show here. Their stomach acids are 1,000 times stronger than a human's.
What is happening right
Hold
now?
On. So that's how they can do it. So we talk about the long tail, you know, this idea that there's everything that's out there is going to be around forever and nothing goes away truly. That is a very recent phenomenon because certainly the golden age of television, the golden age of radio, whole episodes are just gone. They evaporated into the ether. Some of them got taped over
right.
in many cases.
Erased
completely. And there is a hole right about the 70s and 80s when there was a lot of really disposable culture that got disposed of. And they were theoretically available, but you had to be a researcher or something. You couldn't do it.
Or you had to be my mom.
Exactly.
Making beta tapes of it.
That is true.
At cons, yes, and things like that, yeah. But for the mass public, it didn't really happen until, for a show that I'm thinking of, speaking of rotting, in the mid-70s, there were two shows called, one was called The $6 Million Man. Hold that thought. I'm going to stop you there. And another show called The Bionic Woman. The $6 Million Man was a show about a dude who could run fast, who could lift heavy things if they were on the right side of his body, and he could see far with one eye. The Bionic Woman was the $6 Million Man for gay people. Both of those were available. Both of those were sort of gone until a network called Cozy. Anybody know Cozy TV? C-O-Z-I.
Oh, yeah.
TV.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as a name, I think just kind of sounds sort of aggressively condescending. It's like, we know you want this comfort food. We know you want this potato chip. Eat it. Eat it. They started showing. And so there was this feeling where all of a sudden, a show that I had not seen in 42 years was waiting for me. This feeling I had, this mix of anticipation and dread, is not going to be a thing anymore. Because all the stuff that you toddlers like is archived forever and will be easy to get. But that feeling was a thing that's going away, that's not going to be in the world anymore. And the shows are terrible, turns out. Aggressively terrible. And it's all very Southern California, right? It's all filmed in Southern California. So all the car chases, and there are lots of car chases, take place within the same six blocks of the warehouse district of LA. All of the outdoor stuff is kind of grubby. It's all filmed in like the scrub brush of Ojai. And I thought to myself...
The Real Scrub Brushes of Ojai, by the way, is one of my favorite Bravo shows.
There you go.
Go ahead.
The, After seeing one, I thought, okay, this is written for kids. After seeing three, I realized this wasn't written for kids. This was written for really intelligent dogs. Terrible. So that's an example of something rotting that I continue to
pick over. You just skipped right over that. It's written for dogs. So anyway, yeah. Why?
It's dumb.
Oh, dumb.
Very, very dumb.
Oh, dumb.
Yeah.
Your dog's feelings are going to be hurt
now,
when he hears this.
He can take it. He's a good big guy.
All right. So that's an example for you. Stephen, what's an example for you, bud?
I guess what I was thinking about with this topic was that the way that, you know how everything feels infinite right now? That like a show.
Has it?
No, I want to get a little deep here, man. Just sit tight.
Okay.
That a show will die, and then it'll come back, and then it'll die again, and then it'll be brought back.
Right.
And you have that endless cycle of like you see this movie, Wet Hot American Summer, and then all of a sudden, you know what, 15 years later, there's a whole bunch of shows surrounding it.
And you know there's a new MacGyver.
There is a new MacGyver coming this fall. And I kind of wanted to speak out in defense of things actually dying. I find that it is actually easier to go back and really dig into something that's no longer on TV anymore when you kind of have a pretty good sense that there's a conclusion to it.
Right.
Sure.
Last week or the week before, the show Nashville got canceled. And I was sad. It's a cute show. I like a lot of the songwriting on it. But when I trudged home, and I was really worried because I got to tell my girlfriend, who really likes this show, like, this show is going away. And her reaction was, oh, now I can watch it. Like now I can watch it and know that I'll eventually be done. And I think that in the age of infinity that we're in, like, knowing that something has a conclusion makes it easier actually to go back into it and really get lost in it.
Right.
Because you don't feel like you have this potential of getting farther and farther behind. I had a conversation with someone last night who said that they had very recently given up on The Simpsons. And I thought, first of all, wow, you waited a long time.
That was my thought too. I was like, just now? Yeah. Like,
and The Simpsons still has good episodes. And
no,
I think,
sure.
And I think one of the big transitions that I made as a Simpsons fan was going from the high stakes experience of watching it live as it happens and risking crushing disappointment to just like blazing through them on DVD or syndication or whatever, where the stakes are much, 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 much lower. And I've kind of hit a point a little bit with The Simpsons where it's like, once The Simpsons goes off the air, like, then I can go back and watch the whole run, but it doesn't necessarily feel like it's time yet. And the problem is that The Simpsons will never go off the air.
Right. No, that's true.
The Simpsons will bury us all.
Right.
And
that's why I always say it's this generation's Gunsmoke.
It's this generation's Gunsmoke. Lots and lots of similarities.
Many.
But I mean, you know, we've tried not to be too morbid about the
world. Have we?
I've tried to be a little less morbid, but when your favorite entertainer or musician dies, that does sometimes, first of all, you know, you have the like, oh, this person has died, part of the mourning process, like when Prince died, part of the mourning process is to go back and listen to a bunch of Prince music. And I feel like that it hadn't necessarily been possible to fully go back and celebrate Prince's legacy while he was alive, in part because the last 20, 25 years of his output wasn't very good. And so, like,
wasn't consistent.
Wasn't consistent. Yeah. You would really have to pan for gems. And so, whenever there's finality attached to a cultural work, that makes it a lot easier to be the vulture that we were talking about.
Yeah, sure. Audie Cornish, I feel like you have too much going on in your life.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I had a hard time with this one.
Politics
trying to figure
things.
Out what to
do
say.
Do you like pick over old stuff or do you not?
The more something is in the zeitgeist, the less I'm interested in going back to it.
Interesting.
It makes it, there's like a mental block then, you know, all of a sudden I'm just like, oh, it's so good. That seems like so much work.
Right.
You know, and I just like can't bring myself to actually do it. And then there's some things that don't hold up. Like, I'm one of those people that tried to watch My So-Called Life again because it was on Hulu. And I realized that like, I've changed with this. We're talking about the world changing with streaming, but I have less patience. Mm. So now, a couple episodes in, you know, when I was 15 or whatever, I totally sat through it and was into it. And now, Jordan Catalano comes on, and I'm like, this guy. Am I right?
Like, oh, right?
I can't.
You are right.
I cannot.
I think there's a whole...
We are going to sit down sometime and do like an hour and a half on Jordan Catalano for women
over 30. We are a generation. Like, we're like a dream.
It's like, No way.
So we'll save that for a special show.
We will do
There is one thing I have gone over a couple times, which I'm going to admit in public and on record, which is Sex and the City.
Oh, yeah.
I never, ever, ever watched the show when it was on air because I was poor and no one had cable. Like, I just didn't get that. And as an adult, as a cord cutter, now I've been watching it like on Amazon Prime. And it's interesting. It's actually something that I'm able to pick apart and enjoy and say, like, oh, the first season was really interesting. They were trying to do this or that, and now the storytelling's changed, and why did it change? And it's also something that I've come to appreciate more in terms of programming that's aimed at women and how much of a standard it became, for better or worse, that something was either better or worse than Sex and the City. And I sort of have an appreciation for it that I didn't at all before.
Yeah. So when I thought about this, I thought about a couple things. One thing is, there are certain things that I pick over, and if you listen to the show, you know, the big one I thought of was Sports Night. Like, everyone knows I pick over Sports Night, but I pick over Sports Night partly because it's on Hulu Plus. It's been on Hulu Plus forever, right? I started picking over it after I bought it on DVD, which didn't happen, you know, right away when it was gone. But now it's on Hulu Plus. I can watch it whenever I want, and I do at work. But then I was comparing that to something like, I was talking on Twitter the other day about the show Sisters. Does anyone watch Sisters? So Sisters was one of these, it was a drama in the 90s-ish. And it was about these four sisters. Celia Ward was one of them. And Julianne Phillips, the former Mrs. Bruce Springsteen. No one knows that.
It's kind of a deep cut.
But eventually, it like this supporting cast, was, you know, Paul Rudd was in it when he was this big, and my dear pal Alan Sepinwall found and tweeted a photo of Paul Rudd in like this, oh, it's this little hat, it's so adorable, from when he was on Sisters, where he was married, by the way, to a young actress by the name of Ashley Judd, who hadn't done anything at that time either. But most importantly, Sisters was the home of the actual invention of the sad George Clooney persona, because that's where he played this detective who was very, very sad. Very, 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 very sexy and very, very sad. And that's where he actually started doing that. Before he did it on ER, he did it on Sisters. And I remember when the fall preview issue arrived, the fall preview of TV Guide arrived at my house, and it was all about this new show, ER, and they had a picture of the doctors all, like, it was this arty shot of them all lying on the ground with their heads in the middle of the circle so that you could kind of see the actors, but he was upside down. And I remember looking at this and going, and I said, that's Falconer. Oh, no, because I knew it meant he was leaving. And eventually they blew him up. It's okay. So but the point is,
25-year-old spoiler.
Exactly. So this is one of these shows. It's not, you can just buy it on DVD. They started putting it out on Shout Factory, which is like the home of things you couldn't buy on DVD. They just started putting it out. I have not bought it on DVD, but it's not streaming. So I don't revisit it. And I don't know whether if I actually did, I would be like, oh, this is terrible. But I adored it when it was on. It was part of kind of like a, what I would call the semi-goodifying of drama before the super-goodifying of drama that happened with, like, The Sopranos and premium cable. There was kind of this stuff of, like, it's not quite as good as China Beach, but it's better than a lot of the other stuff that was kicking around at the time. So I don't get the opportunity to pick over that, which gives me a totally, as Glenn was saying, a totally different kind of nostalgic feeling about it.
Right.
Maybe George Clooney wouldn't be as cute as I thought he was.
Well, I mean, but I mean, that's perish the thought.
Never happened.
But that does raise the interesting point of whether you're better off, whether those shows are better off in the public's estimation for people's inability to see them. Like, I still romanticize what is probably a very stupid drama on ABC called Relativity.
No, that's a great show. Relativity is a great show.
And I remember, you know, swooning over the romance of it all, and particularly the lead. And that show, for whatever reason, probably music licensing, has just never come back. And I think I continue to inflate it in my head to the point where, if I went back and watched it,
Might be terrible.
Didn't you say that Murphy Brown is really hard to find?
Murphy Brown has been hard to find. They show it on Encore. Stars, Encore, I think. So I used to tape it, but yeah, it's hard to find also. They put out the first season on DVD. That's like a super important show.
At the time, that was like one of the most culturally relevant shows on TV.
And one of the things that some of my critic friends have pointed out about Murphy Brown is that it's very tagged to its time by the copious topical references, so it might be that would be a problem if you tried
the politics.
Regarding Sisters, I'm willing to bet that the dude was named Falconer would land on you differently now.
No. I don't think you understand the power of that particular porch. Okay. He was a detective. I don't know if I explained. He was a helpful, nurturing police detective who I think brought Celia Ward, I want to say, a teddy bear at one point because her character's name was Teddy.
Did he tilt his head and smile?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
That's where he learned that.
Yep.
All right. I will be fascinated to hear. Please come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter. Tweet at us at PCHH and tell us about the dead things you've been picking over. It's cool. It's between friends. Do you watch it on Hulu? Do you buy it on DVD? Are you willing to make that step, or have we all gone streaming? We are going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the crossover of politics and pop culture, something that we're all thinking about quite a bit right now. So come right back and be with us.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from the Lagunitas Brewing Company. Popular belief has it that Lagunitas began on a kitchen stove in Northern California in 1993. From actually getting beers into bottles and onto the streets, Lagunitas looks to the future. From expanding the Petaluma Brewery to building a second in Chicago and soon a third in Azusa, California, to bringing its flagship IPA across the pond, Lagunitas could probably make good beer on the moon if needed. Because wherever you go, beer speaks, people mumble. More mumblings at Lagunitas.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Vulture, being culture vultures. Now we're going to talk a little bit about something else that's on our minds in this election year, but, you know, all the time, let's face it, which is the crossover of politics and pop culture, the way that pop culture tries to wrestle with politics. Audie, you are the one who brought this up.
I hope I don't regret that.
And you're not going to regret it. What kinds of stuff does this bring to mind for you?
I think I've been thinking about it a lot because I think that, especially in recent years, trying to get currency out of pop culture, like politicians are really, really pushed that. And we're so far past like Nixon in 68 saying, sock it to me, right?
Sock it to me?
Yeah. And that was such a big deal moment. And now you have like Obama on Between Two Ferns.
Yeah,
and
right.
I think they are constantly trying to get some currency out of it. The other thing that makes me think about it is the way that political people in that world like really... how they obsess over pop culture and try and find themselves in it. And I actually took a note on this because it was so ridiculous. If you like Google Game of Thrones and foreign policy,
oh yeah,
there are hits. Like there are actual things. Like in foreign affairs, like there was this article, Westeros in Washington, Ideas, Identity. And it was talking about security maximizing Lannisters and neocons. And like... it's so nerdy, but you hear people talking like this, like in the hallway or whatever, and on the Hill. Of course, we'll talk about more like shows like Veep and Parks and Rec, but obviously Hollywood is interested but doesn't know how to portray politics. They don't quite get it. And politicians and elected officials definitely don't quite get pop culture. They're afraid of it, and it feels like a minefield. And when they mess up, it's really high stakes for them. They look really foolish.
Yeah. Stephen, are there any kind of portrayals of politics that really work for you in pop culture? Or?
I think in general, and I think I said this on the show at one point, that my favorite portrayal of politics and pop culture right now is Veep. Part of what I love about Veep, it's not specific enough to even establish what political party she belongs to.
Yeah.
It's just about government as a grim, joyless series of thankless chores.
and just
like bogus logistics and just anyway, endless infighting. And I like that because politics, like anything else, is a job. It's just something where like you have the same office politics at the White House that you would have at an aluminum siding company.
Yeah.
And so I like portrayals of politics that make it as general and universal as possible, still looking at the political system, but not necessarily with an agenda. I think agendas, lots of people have political agendas. There's nothing wrong with having a political agenda, but I think that the more universal it is, like the longer it will last, the more people will want to pick over it like vultures. Yeah, call back to the first
one. There you go.
So years skilled. Later. Years later. You know, you watch a movie like Primary Colors now, and it's like, oh, but yeah, I remember 1993. Yeah, he liked women. So I like, a general portrayal. Yeah. I could go into a whole thing about what it's like to try to reflect a specific time. I worked at The Onion for 12 years and dealt with, like, how do you cover each of these major political figures? Yeah. And the kind of canard that, like, a politician who's really outrageous is this great boon to comedians. That's actually not necessarily true.
Right.
The bigger the personality, in some ways, the harder to satirize.
Yeah. We've been talking about that a lot with SNL, you know, this year in particular. Like, you can't do Bernie Sanders better than Bernie Sanders.
Right.
I mean, you could do pretty good.
I mean,
good,
if you're going to, it's going to be Larry David.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, totally.
Or doing Donald Trump or doing whoever. Like, it's actually, I was thinking about this with the documentary about Anthony Weiner that's out.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just this epic portrayal of, like, self-immolation and ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You couldn't have made a movie about a guy like that and really felt like that, like, no. Yeah. Nobody would keep going after that. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. DC is a very odd town. It's a company town. There is one industry in it. And I have been there since 96, and I have circled that industry. But a lot of my friends are in it. They're in government in one way or another. And that means you're going to be out at lunch, and somebody is going to say, guys, that's the Undersecretary of the Treasury, you know? And then, which is weird enough and stupid, but then somebody else will say, Sarah Bloom Raskin, she's here, you know? And it's like, that's, don't do that.
Yeah, I got once at like a swimming pool, like, that's Grover Norquist.
See, that's it. This, and it leeches into me. I was walking down the street this week, and I had this thought, Lamar Alexander. And I thought, I have been in this town too long.
I had that experience seeing Tom Tancredo in there the lobby of NPR. He was in doing an interview. I was like,
Yeah. So I actually asked some of my friends, their legislative directors, their schedulers, their chiefs of staff. I put this question to them. What pieces of pop culture get politics right? What don't they? So shoe leather reporting. That's what you got right here. Science facts. Shoe leather reporting. They wanted to talk more about what pop culture gets wrong. So, A, House of Cards is just silly. B, no one in the West Wing talks like the West Wing, which I think makes sense, because nobody talks like the West Wing.
No.
My friend Luke really liked the novels of Ward Just. He named three books, Echo House, The Congressman Who Loved Flaubert, and a book called Honor, Power, Riches, Fame, and the Love of Women, which I happen to have tattooed on my thigh. And this weekend, they all have Hulu, and they're all sending me texts saying, I love Wiener, I love Wiener, I love Wiener.
It's incredible.
At least I think it was from them.
Yeah.
How did I walk into that?
Yeah, I was waiting for that. Yeah. But the last thing that happened in this group text that I emailed, so it wasn't really shoe leather, it was a group text. This one person, my friend Karen, wrote a 5-sentence paragraph, which should make us all fear for the future of the American Republic, because this is what she said, and everybody agreed, Veep gets it exactly right. Specifically the details. What she mentioned is that the idea of the body man played by Tony Hale, this is such a weird, specific thing to DC, but the fact that you would have a dude in the room where all these decisions are being made who is there, omnipresent, but has no status at all. That disconnect is something that you just don't see anywhere else. You wouldn't see anywhere else, but that specificity is why Veep is Veep.
Yeah. For me, I mean, one of the things that I always find frustrating about pop culture portrayals of politics is that they tend to be very focused on the acts of extraordinary individuals, like people in office.
Right.
So you have things like the West Wing, or people who work in government at least. You have the West Wing, you have Veep, you have House of Cards. And in most of those, the electorate is largely absent, right? And if there's any satire that's aimed at the electorate, it's largely limited to the idea that they're easily duped, right?
Idiocracy.
That idiocracy, that kind of idea. It's very difficult to write or create a satire that effectively gets at issues with how people vote and how people behave politically as individuals. Because I used to work at a state legislature, and one of the things that I said when I came out of that job is, like, the thing that people don't know is that all the things that politicians do that you hate, they're doing because they're rewarded for doing them. They're not necessarily a craven person. They have found that that is what they are rewarded for by voters. And it's the same thing that voters say they hate. And it's a really complicated relationship, but it's very difficult for pop culture to get at that idea that it's very difficult for truly terrible things to happen without some kind of politically maladaptive behavior by the electorate. That's really difficult for them to kind of reach. And I think for me, that's always what's missing. You know, you have kind of the Mr. Smith goes to Washington, so you get kind of the heroic portrayal, or the incredibly cynical portrayals like Veep, or you get, I would put the West Wing back in that kind of heroic portrayal, although they were always fighting people who are more the baddie type. But it's difficult to kind of get at the whole of politics if you're talking about extraordinary individuals and you can't really talk about collective behavior, which is largely what politics is.
I also think it's not an accident that we're talking about television, because with movies, politics is not like just about the pursuit of power. There's also, once you have the power, what you do with it.
Right.
But for the movies, they just need like one big story.
Right.
And then you land, you know, like Tracy Flick gets in the sedan at the end of election and you're supposed to be like, muhahaha, you know, like more to come.
But that's one of the ones that I think does almost get at like electorate stuff, because it's so intimate. It's so small. You can kind of get more at how that behavior works. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. It just means that a show like Veep, which gets at what it's like to sit in a meeting when your boss doesn't understand Twitter, or to be in a hallway with a bunch of guys who need their suits dry cleaned. Like,
theoretically.
They do the part, the everyday slog. And even Parks and Rec, I think, gets at the idealism that does exist.
Right.
You meet congressmen when you're out during an election time who actually believe in a thing.
Right.
Now, what happens once they get there, God knows. Mm-hmm. But like, if you really, like, I think, conveyed actually something positive.
Yeah, I think election is a really, really important example of this, and an important example of what I love when politics and pop culture intersect, which is a story about very small human beings in a very small but still universal thing that is not necessarily commenting on specific, as you say, great figures in politics who brought about change. It's much more about the process, and you're much more extrapolating the behavior in this movie to the behavior on a grander scale.
Right.
But that is a favorite movie of mine.
Yeah, I'm going to stick up for cynicism for a second. It is grounded in past experience, when it is grounded in past failures in many cases, then it is realism. In a way, it's a hedge against the popular definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing and expecting different results. Cynicism is a bulwark against that. The problem with a lot of political satire, I think, is that the cynicism isn't earned, it's lazy. It's automatic, it's reflexive, it's the atmosphere. And I think you can see a difference. I think when there is, instead of laziness, a note of outrage, that's powerful. That's what political satire is
meant
to do.
Give me an example.
An example is Jon Stewart's Daily Show, back in the day. There was a sense of something, a sense of anger that felt righteous at the status quo, that didn't feel like he was ticking a box. The West Wing, in another way, had a different kind of outrage. It was an impatience with laziness and the belief that you could affect change by lecturing people.
I was going to say impatience with women. I think Parks and Rec, to its credit too, also gets at some of those smaller stories of the interactions between politicians and the people that they work for, because you would see stories like the story when Leslie did the gay penguin wedding. And she starts off thinking, I just want to get this over with as quickly as possible. I want to just sort of like, I didn't mean anything by it. I didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to marry gay penguins. I wasn't trying to say anything about gay marriage. And then she's kind of championed for being a champion of gay marriage. And she finds that incredibly satisfying, both from an ego perspective and from a kind of like, oh, hey, maybe this is the right thing to do, and maybe I've done something really good. And she kind of reacts to that and then kind of shifts her position relative to that. I think sometimes they were very good at telling those, you know, I don't think every one of them worked that they did that was like that, that was meant to be kind of a stand-in for grander political arguments. But I think some of the time, at least, they were very effective.
I want to stick up for Scandal.
Yes.
Pause. Because I've had little back and forths with friends who are like House of Cards versus Scandal, because there are people who are like, Scandal is a guilty pleasure and is so ridiculous, but somehow House of Cards, just because the lighting's worse, is like much more of a thing to take seriously. And to me, I'm like, first of all, there's way too much murder no matter what,
right.
You know?
Like, right, they both have too much murder.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, if I see something weird in the paper sometimes, I'm like, Scandal, you know? But generally, there's murder on both shows. And they're also intrigued with the idea of a political marriage. And I think that is something that works because we can all kind of identify with relationships and the kind of alliances forming and reforming, and what that's something people can actually make good with. And I think it's just much harder for Hollywood to deal with any kind of policy type stuff, because that involves taking a side, that involves ideology, and that involves maybe alienating half of your audience.
Right.
They never want to do that. I mean, yeah. West Wing kind of notwithstanding, and as you said, it was like, lecture the bad guys until the music swells.
Right.
Some people found that show insufferable.
And Scandal, I think, too, has a good handle on the way that some of its evil is decayed idealism, and some of those people have become very embittered toward each other over time, but originally thought we're doing something good. I think even the story about kind of like fixing the election, there was originally some kernel of he will be a good president, and that's the reason why we're doing this. And then at some point, once you start murdering people, your idealism has kind of, you can't really claim the high road quite so easily. But I think that's one of the other things that I like about the Scandal.
And they get the idea of how, literally, how Scandal can develop, how one question, one germ of something somewhere can escalate like so quickly into an avalanche of questions, and the panic you feel in the rooms as people are trying to fix that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've never been in the room. I'm always outside of it, but you can see the panic on their faces.
Yeah.
A book I want to recommend along these lines is The Speechwriter by Barton Swain. And this is a guy who actually was a staff writer for Governor Mark Sanford in South Carolina when the governor went missing, like said he was going to be in the hiking the Appalachian Trail, and of course was seeing his girlfriend in Argentina.
Yeah.
And the book kind of chronicles like this, a character like this, right, a thinly veiled character, and what that was like for the whole staff to like get those phone calls and figure out what to say and how kind of weird the guy was. it's really good read.
So they fictionalized Mark Sanford?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the tricky things. When you were trying to in some way impersonate or represent a specific public figure, there are so many pitfalls in that.
This goes back to your primary colors point.
Yeah, which is the yeah, they're talking about primary colors of like, well, that's obviously Bill Clinton, or even like SNL, you know, when Saturday Night Live is trying to tackle like, how do we do, how do we portray Obama when we have one black person on our cast?
Right.
But also like, some people are easier to parody than others. Yeah. And like, sometimes you try to pick like a running joke, and like somebody like Bill Clinton was actually a huge challenge for comedians and shows that were trying to satirize him, because you had that whole Jay Leno late night talk show, he likes women, he likes food.
Yeah.
Like doing something a little bit more nuanced than that, when being at a humor publication at the time, that was very difficult. Like, we actually really loved covering Bob Dole in 1996, because Bob Dole, and what we decided was that Bob Dole was a robot. And so you would have headlines like terrorist bombing destroys Bob Dole's outer hull. and you know, they would have like the little Terminator face, you know, kind of through the charred flesh. That was funny. Like, I actually, from a comedic standpoint, think that candidates who are a little bit more of a blank slate in some ways are actually funny.
It allows you to kind of impose a comedic POV.
They become a canvas on which you can draw silly things.
Maybe that's what happened with Joe Biden and the Uncle Joe thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I remember the last White House Correspondents' Dinner, people were really into the Uncle Joe.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's into it now at this point.
Oh, yeah.
This kind of lost its edge then, but yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, I have found this conversation fascinating. I hope that some of you will come and find us again on social media and tell us what you think about portrayals of politics and pop culture. Feel free to weigh in on House of Cards versus what I heard myself refer to as the Scandal. I'm legally all of your aunt now. All right, we are going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Woo! Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve, to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are ready to do our favorite segment of this week and every week here at our live show at the Vulture Festival. So I'm going to start, of course, with Stephen Thompson. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I am not going to lie. I'm going to pander without hesitation to this festival and how wonderful it has been and just how exciting it's been to be here. I think it's been wonderfully programmed. Yesterday, I got a chance to take in a couple of presentations, one by Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is a show that we've talked about on Pop Culture Happy Hour before and really loved, and one with Animated Voices, where I got to see some, got to just completely nerd out as people from like Bob's Burgers and Futurama and The Family Guy and just all these people, you know, and like doing all their stuff. And so I've really gotten a bunch of chances to fan out and embarrass myself in front of people I admire, which has been extraordinarily fun. And one of the most unexpected of those happened when we first came here on Friday. And Linda grabs my sleeve and goes, "That's Matt Saracen from Friday Night Lights." I'm like, is it tugging at my arm. She's like, "It's QB1, it's QB1. And I'm like, no, you know, that, are you sure? Yes, it is. And like almost kind of pushes me to him and I'm like, nah, I can't do that.
Well, no, at first you didn't believe me.
Right. But eventually you texted my girlfriend who said that if I didn't get a picture with him, it was over. And so I finally sheepishly go over and bother poor Zach Guilford. And immediately we got into this long and animated conversation about how much we both love the NPR Politics podcast. And it's not just like, oh, yeah, I like podcasting, NPR, This American Life, right? No, he was like, I love Domenico Montanaro, I love Sam Sanders, and just like starts listing his favorite. Listing it, and so, like, where I come out of this in terms of recommending something that you yourself and people at home can experience going forward, take it from QB1 and me. Yep. I have been obsessively listening to the NPR Politics podcast. I like to think that it's got a little sprinkle of Pop Culture Happy Hour fairy dust in its in its formatting, but it is such, it's got the great and good Ron Elving, so many of my favorite people at NPR, and it's just, if you are interested in politics, and we've talked about politics on the show, it is absolutely superb. So not only getting my dumb face mashed against the face of QB1, but getting a chance
to save your relationship.
To save my relationship. Our shared celebration of the NPR Politics podcast, which everyone should download.
That is wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. Both of them are streaming comedy series. The first one is one that I should have known about, well, I did know about for 4 years, because it premiered in 2012. And everybody that I know has been telling me to see it. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then I, to myself, was like, no way in hell, because it's about disaffected 20-somethings in Brooklyn.
No offense.
Yeah. And it's also you know, it revolves around a gay couple or an ex-gay couple. And there are so many gay web series where they're very broad, they're very big, they're joke, and because it's a gay series, they hire actors for their percent body fat. They hire actors for their pectoral development.
So what's the problem, though?
Yeah. The problem is...
Audie's like, what are these series?
The problem is that when something is so joke-dense, you need somebody who can put a joke over, not just look pretty. How many people are watching The Outs? Okay. The first series came out in 2012. The next series, the second season, is out now, just on Vimeo. So you can get the first series for free. The second season is now you have to pay for it. It's worth it. It is so well written. It is so nuanced and subtle and well acted and gorgeous. and incredibly moving, smart about relationships. It's about this gay couple who are no longer a gay couple and how they figure out how to go about their lives. Funny but never strained. Funny but the beats of the jokes are in actual dialogue that people would actually say to each other. It's great. That's The Outs. The second one is a series that just premiered this weekend, so I haven't had a chance to get into too many episodes, but people, we live in a world where they gave the great Maria Bamford a show. How lucky we are to be alive right now, because Maria Bamford has a show, which is called Lady Dynamite, which is so her. It does not feel slick, mass-produced. It feels like it. You can feel the heartbeat of this show. You can feel her behind it. It's not necessarily joke, 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 joke. It's very really weird, 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 weird. But that's fantastic.
It's Netflix, right?
What's that?
Netflix?
It's on Netflix. You should download it. It's fantastic. Lady Dynamite.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week?
All right, I have two things. First, a movie which is coming out soon called The Fits, and it's about this young girl in Cincinnati who's a bit of a tomboy. She hangs out at a rec center doing sort of boxing with her brother, and she wants to be in the dance troupe next door, and some of the young women in the dance troupe fall prey to some mysterious seizures. And it is this movie that feels mystical and transfixing and meditative and also menacing and really gets at how weird that age is. That's like 11, 12. You're basically like your face is up against the glass of teenness, you know, and people are talking about love and sex and you don't quite know what's going on and everything feels strange and opaque. And also how much downtime there is when you're a kid, right? We forget how much tedium there was. You just would look at the clock and be like, for real? Like, when is this over? Anyway, so The Fits, amazing. The woman starring, this young girl starring in her name's Royalty Hightower is amazing. And then the other thing is a pop culture happy hour thing. I've been on the show a couple times and I've mentioned my beef with movies that have a journalist who has sex with a source. And yep. A few of you have been very sweet to tweet me instances of when this happens to complain about it. And some of you have been calling this the Audie Cornish rule. I don't know if I want that yet, but let's keep this movement going until we can convince Hollywood otherwise. Someone in my mentions the other day, which is a very Drake thing to say, sent me a link to this post on a website called The Toast. And it's a day in the life. Toast, very awesome. A Day in the Life of a Fictional Female Reporter by Mallory Ortberg. Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the day starts 9:17, sleep with a source. 10:58, find powder blue Oxford shirt that doesn't quite button up over my breast by 8. 11, internet. The day goes on until, you know, finally we get to the afternoon. After you've sabotaged a source's career in order to get the big scoop after sleeping with him one last time. 3:20, stare expressionlessly at the computer monitor as if to say, what have I done? Which is actually how I spend my time. That was like the one thing
that's
on the schedule
that's the true part.
That was
yeah.
totally right.
Yeah.
There's more sex after that. But anyway, it was a day in the life of a fictional female reporter. Check it out. Keep tweeting me violations of the Audie Cornish rule.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you very much, Audie Cornish. Like Stephen, I want to start by just saying how much I appreciate being here. This is our 297th full episode, so we're coming right up to 300. We have been doing this for going on 6 years, since a little bit before podcasting was doing quite as well as it is now. And I think we're all just very grateful that we've gotten to do it for so long. And obviously, the support of everybody at NPR, but especially like the fact that somebody like Audie, who is like a real serious person.
Despite what you've seen here.
That people like Audie and Ari and Bob Mondello and people who come out of really the traditional form of NPR have been so good to us and so kind to us. And the people who have produced for us. Mike, who helped us invent the show. And,
actually, Mike Katziff, who it's his theme song, too, is actually sitting right there if you want to.
Yeah, so you can clap there. And I also also just wanted to say Vulture is also very dear to my heart. Vulture, freelancing for Vulture is one of the jobs that helped me survive when I left a job without having another job in 2008. They've been very, very sweet and very supportive to me, and it's so nice to kind of have this somewhat full circle opportunity to be here at their festival, which I, like Stephen, have found really, really wonderful and lovely. This was Upfronts Week, where the networks started releasing all the stuff about their new shows. Not so much fall, but over the next year, a lot of it is mid-season now. There was one trailer that I really liked, which was for an ABC comedy called Speechless, which is about a family where their oldest son has special needs and uses a wheelchair. They actually cast a young actor whose name is Micah Fowler, who has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair himself. His mother is played by Minnie Driver, who, if you've ever seen Minnie Driver in, like, Will and Grace or stuff like that, she has some towering comedic powers. I'm very optimistic about it. It's super early days. I haven't seen anything except the trailer. Again, I encourage you to seek it out. It's called Speechless. And that is what is making me happy this week, that and the opportunity to be here with this lovely, lovely, lovely festival. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow our Audie at NPR Audie. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy and our producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Producer emeritus and music director is what I mean to say. So I want to thank all of you so much for being here. This was so much fun. And thanks to all of you guys for doing this show with me. And we will see you right back here next week.
Hey, we wanted to let you know that one of your favorite NPR podcasts is back. Invisibilia returns with season 2 on June 17th. Invisibilia explores the invisible forces that shape human behavior, thoughts, emotions, assumptions, expectations. This season, Invisibilia goes to a prison, an oil rig, a McDonald's in Russia, and a beach in New Jersey to explore the invisible forces at play in our institutions, work, family, governments. You can catch up on season 1 of Invisibilia anytime and listen to a preview of season 2 now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.